So hello and welcome wherever you are in the world and whatever time it is to Beyond Bitcoin. Why Beyond Bitcoin? Because after all, there's a great deal that is beyond Bitcoin within this cryptocurrency or crypto assets or digital asset space. Bitcoin, of course, represents one of 11,500 tokens that are out there currently, and there'll be many more coming. So our prime interest today is going to be an interesting topic around community and around government regulation. It's a juicy topic and one that covers both technical and philosophical. So, but before we go there, a brief introduction to who we are. My name is Derek Graham. I am the CEO of the Portal Asset Management. Portal Asset Management is the sponsor to Portal Digital Fund. Actually, I often describe this space as kind of a very large river that's heading down to the ocean. It's full of eddies. It's got subcurrents through it. You know, you really don't know whether those eddies or subcurrents are going to survive, but you're absolutely sure that that river is heading towards an enormous ocean, and that ocean is the future of commerce. That's how we view it in Portal Asset Management. And we view that by saying our prime task with the Portal Digital Fund is making sure that we don't run into a bridge, a bank, or a billabong. By the way, for those not living in the land of Oz, a billabong is a U-shaped river that gets cut off and sits there and the river keeps flowing past it. Mind you, in fund management terms, they would call that a side pocket, where they put something that isn't performing at the moment, but they hope it might perform in the future. Anyway, I get off track. So enough analogy now. Across to Nitin. Hello, Nitin. And how are you going? And what's your week been like?
Thank you, Derek. That was really funny, by the way. Great analogies. My name is Nitin. I serve as Director of Financial Sciences and Digital Assets at IBM. Also founded the Blockchain Labs and subsequently Digital Asset Labs at IBM. I also serve as CTO and head of research for Portal Asset Management, where we spend our time in understanding the space, figuring out the right research methodology, so we don't end up in a billabong-like situation as you described. So really glad to be here.
Great. Hey, so look, a couple of sort of throw topics in, but we're not going to go into them deep today. And that is that just this week alone, and remember, this space, a year in this space is a year in dog years. So a dog year broadly is 7 years. I would argue a week in this space is 7 weeks in normal commerce. So we've never lacked a topic to discuss. So this week alone, Thailand's SEC equivalent has proposed a new set of rules for crypto custodians. Korea's SEC equivalent has stated that they intend to establish further regulations around the space. And in India, they've stated they've launched a new monitoring system to monitor the financial transactions within cryptocurrency. Now, for those libertarians and et cetera out there, they probably throw their arms up in the air. But the fact of the matter is that means governments are starting to, continuing to take this space seriously. And I hope create nurturing environments, I hope, to see this space occur. But what we're really going to talk about today is a great robbery. This is a robbery of $610 million that has been hacked by a fellow that's been pleasantly called a white hat hacker. I think that's cunningly called that by Poly, by the Poly network. And so, and around August 10, this gentleman hacked into the Poly network, and he removed $610 million of assets. But those assets included 28,953 ETH, 1,032 Bitcoin, and a whole bundle of US dollar Tether, etc. So a pretty juicy group of assets, and within 24 hours he returned around half of it, which is an odd thing to do for a criminal. And he then started to make statements saying, "Oh, I'm just doing this for fun. I'm just seeing how strong this is." Now, what we're going to talk about a little bit is the fact that this just wouldn't have happened if someone had stolen $6 million from a bank. What you would have seen is you would have seen the cavalry race in and the police arrive and the sirens going the FBI out, but these people really weren't involved with this process. This process was community driven. The community of the surrounding hackers, the community of the holders of Tether, the community of the other major blockchains connected to it, they all gathered together to make this fellow's heist virtually useless. But to start with, I thought, let's before we get to that, Nitin, explain what Poly Network is and what this interoperability hack was and why he managed to get so much from it and whether it was in fact illegal. It's a fair number of things there. Off you go.
No, I think this is super exciting and all happening in real time. I would say that it would be like a movie unfolding in real time, which had suspense, it had motive, it had crime, it had investigation, it had all the elements of a great juicy sort of story that unfolds in a typical movie. But I think it's important to understand a few things, Derek, as you were describing these things, is for the audiences to know what a typical hack was in the past. And I think a few notable elements here were the fact that this was the largest hack ever, $611 million. And you see every time we see a hack, the numbers keep going up. And that story itself indicates that the crypto and the blockchain driven digital asset space is sort of growing exponentially, and every hack becomes even more valuable than the last one. So if you were to sort of unpack this whole story around this, historically all the hacks were around someone's losing their keys being stolen, or somebody taking over your computer and having access to your digital wallet that happens to be on your browser, like MetaMask, for example, and using that as an avenue to steal your funds, or taking advantage of a vulnerability in a smart contract, like we have seen past Ethereum. Nothing illegal, just happens to be, for example, the very first hack, which was, by the way, $56 million, basically allowed people to create sub-accounts and allow you to be able to take a small piece of that fund and move them in sub-accounts. Not exactly illegal. The smart contract lets you do it, and people took advantage of it because they had knowledge of that ability to do it. So historically, there was a challenge either with a smart contract vulnerability or design, or people stole the keys, and that's how these attacks were performed. This one is different and interesting because it leads to a lot more other in-depth knowledge of blockchains per se. So let me spend some time in explaining what this, and feel free to ask me questions. In this case, is that interoperability. For example, we have 800 plus different blockchains in the world. 12 of them are meaningful, which means they're dominant in terms of growing the ecosystem. And what ends up happening is that, for example, Ethereum has an ecosystem, Algorand has an ecosystem, NEO as one of the chains has an ecosystem. And if you, Derek, as an investor, wants to take advantage of all the emerging ecosystem, like Solana this week was in news because the largest amount of DeFi projects are moving to Solana at the moment because of cost structures. And so as these chains evolve, and as the projects on these chains evolve, interoperability is the issue. How do you move an asset from one chain to other? That is still a technical problem because Ether can survive on Ether, on Ethereum. You can exchange Ethereum for other assets on Ethereum, but Ethereum is not a currency that's valued or accepted in a Bitcoin network. And so many of these projects are trying to develop a mechanism which allows you to take these assets and make sure they're interoperable, which is an ability for you to be able to move assets from one chain to another chain and be able to take advantage of the ecosystem and economy that these chains support. And so in that context, Poly Network is one of those networks, and there are many such application level gateways emerging to say, you should be able to take advantage of the arbitrage between chains and move the asset between chains. But how does one source chain, which is in this case Poly Network, ensure the transaction actually happened on Ethereum? So if Derek wants to sell his Ether or move his Ether onto Ethereum and say collateralize it on a Ethereum project, then how does the base chain, which is Poly Network, ensure that actually happened? So they have to rely on something called bridges, or what they call keepers. And they said that instead of me going through all the way to Ethereum, wait for the transaction to happen, verify the transactions, I will have my guards, or the bridges in this case happen to be keepers. I'll rely upon a bunch of keepers to sort of give me the validation. And once I have the validation, I will release the asset to be moved, so to speak. And so you don't necessarily have to go through a complicated security, which is what consensus and many blockchains do, is they have these massive networks that keep the network secure from any such hacks. But in this case, all you had to do is take advantage of these keepers, which is the bridges, and manipulate the bridges and indicate to the source network, which in this case happens to be Poly Network, to trick them into thinking the transaction actually happened, because Poly Network had to rely upon the sentries on the bridges to confirm the actual transaction that may have happened on Ethereum when it actually did not. So you're sort of creating fake transactions and tricking the source network and releasing your asset in that context. And that's what happened.
So then it's very often said that the code is the law in this space. All right then. So the code was faulty. And this gentleman, Mr. White Hat Hacker, that they like to refer to him as, this gentleman used the code to remove or transfer money. Do you think he broke the law?
So two things. One is the code, he took advantage of a bad security design on behalf of Poly Network. I would say that the White Hat Hacker, if that's what, let's call him a White Hat Hacker, though that may not be entirely true, but let's call him.
No, that's right.
You know, he took advantage. So at the end of the day, the fault here is really in poor technology design of Poly Network, which a hacker took advantage of for its own gain. So if from, and I'm not the arbiter of moral, you know, guidance here, but I think the way this was done was illegal. No doubt about that. Whether it's a moral question or an ethical question, a legal question, only because this was done in a stealth way, things were manipulated. It is similar to what we have seen in traditional finance world. And we will talk about India in a few minutes, but there was a bunch of things that happened in Bank of Bangladesh last year and India, where some rogue employees initiated transactions on a Swift network. And that was, you know, debated and caught. It took them 80 days to get to that point, which was instant in this case. But it was illegal, even though it's the employees, legit employees with badge access, initiate the transaction, but they were manipulated. And similarly, instead of employees, these were the bots or the keepers of the bridges who were manipulated because there was a vulnerability. Now, if I were to design the system all over again as a technologist, I would not rely upon a few. That's what consensus in most blockchains is all about. I would rely upon transaction confirmation from one chain to another, and only then perform an action, as opposed to relying upon the sentry and the bridges, because they are easy to manipulate than manipulating the entire Ethereum or Bitcoin network, so to speak. So it's, I would say partly that Poly Network was at fault in terms of how they designed the system. Also, lesson for all of us in the space, you know, what to look for when we look for validity for projects, for instance. But I would say that, yes, it's illegal, and it was a faulty design, and someone took advantage of that. And to me, in many cases, it was brilliant because it sort of brought forward not just the poor design and what future networks would have to consider, but it also brought the community together. And we'll talk about that in a few.
Yeah, exactly. Look, it's interesting. We those are the generation that might have watched a Dirty Harry movie or thought Law and Order was a wonderful thing to constantly watch. And America, after all, seems to be obsessed with law and order and you know, that equivalent thing. You know, they'll see someone go into a bank and steal money. And, you know, they'll be angry that there's a fella that steals money, but there's probably part of them that turns around and says, yeah, but that's okay, it's from a bank. You know, it's interesting here in Australia, a long time ago, we had a fella that stole $30,000-$40,000 as an armed robbery. And at the same time, an entrepreneur stole $1.05 billion. And so the entrepreneur, he stole that by moving it from one company to the other and then plundering it. And the entrepreneur that did that went to jail for 3 years. And the fellow that did the armed robbery went to jail for 7 years. And when they did the calculation between the two, and I'm sorry, I don't have the exact number here, the entrepreneur should have gone to jail for something like 40,000 years if you were to do a proportionate amount of time. And so you know, it's funny that mankind has these set of belief systems that determine what is totally wrong and what is not right, et cetera. And then to a degree, our just human nature starts working when it comes to community. And here we are with a fellow that hacked $600 million worth of a variety of assets. And he ran into a few problems. You know, he was called Mr. White Hat Hacker because a black hat hacker steals, a white hat hacker provides advice. I think Poly Network just kindly called him that in the hope that he would send the money back. So I think that was a cunning PR plan to call him Mr. White Hat Hacker. But nonetheless, you know, when he got his $600 million, it all sits on a set of blockchains and sits in a set of accounts. He's trapped.
Yeah.
It's a hell of a hard time. The first time he goes out and buys himself a canary yellow Lamborghini, he's had it. And he'll be tracked down.
Right.
So he had the problem of having way too much money that was way too heavily hacked, which is a technology, which is a great technology advantage. So for those that are cynical and they're turning around and say, look at this space, it's dangerous. Hey, that was stolen, huge amount, and he's got nowhere to go with it. That is interesting in itself. And the second thing is, of course, the community came in. And what happened there is the US dollar tether group turned around and said, no, we're locking that money in place. Other exchanges turned around and said, no, we're going to make sure that this doesn't happen and you can't transfer it. Members of the community who thought they might know who he is started to say, you know, we might know who he is. And so the community came together to actually close off the opportunity for this fellow to steal $611 million US dollars equivalent, to a point where he had to give it back. Now, just think about that. So you've got a Dirty Harry movie here. Some fellow's stolen $610,000. He's raced off in the car, gets to the end of the suburbs, and then goes, I can't spend this money. Jumps back in the car, races back in, says, look, really sorry about that. Here's your money back. It's a very different world, isn't it? And it's a world that the community plays an extraordinarily important role in. And what you're getting there, I think, is you're getting the return to humanity that utilizes technology in a way that the tribe or the community is actually back in control of how that community is handled.
Right.
That's quite extraordinary because we're not racing to the FBI to solve this problem. I mean, you know, Poly Network might have called them really quickly, but it wasn't the FBI that solved this problem. Law and order didn't come in. There wasn't a judge. There was no color in this and no guns. It was just a community that said, don't do that. You need to send that money back. And he had no choice but to send it back.
Yeah.
I think that's a quantum change in how societies work. What do you think?
Well, if you have no romance of thievery and robbing a bank, then what's the point of living, Derek? We have no story to tell to our kids anymore about, you know, the bank heists, so to speak. No, I'm just kidding. But absolutely, I think so. There's a company called Slowmist, which, again, there's no FBI, no law enforcement, no traditional supervisory element. So let me just break this down two or three other things, which I think we should just look at this from a perspective of things that you were alluding to, is the better future, the better financial network that we're building. First thing is the act, right? The act happened in a split second. It was known, as opposed to traditional financial crimes that oftentimes takes a few days, a few weeks, and sometimes a few months to detect. So it is instantly known. And the communication, not only on social media, but also through traditional blockchain network, every blockchain has a memo field. And the memo field was effectively used to communicate between the various entities, both by the white hat hacker as well as the community, to communicate messages that these blocks contain. So that was a brilliant, interesting thing, that not only message was flowing in the blockchain as a transaction network, but is also all over Twitter. And the community responded both in terms of, and they call them white hat, you know, white hat hacker. And typical, by the way, the typical fees for a white hat hacker is about 5%. So I think there's still about $200-300 million that's still outstanding, and the remaining was returned because this company called Slomist, going back to market supervision and supervisory element of the law enforcement and the regulation that is really after this piece or after this technology, was almost instant. The Slomist was able to detect some wallets, was able to alert the assets, which is basically the addresses of namely Tether, because many of these stable coins are, as you know, centralized systems that they are backed by collateral, and Tether could easily say, you know, I'm just not, because the in case of stable coins, it's a token that's issued by a centralized entity, and when you redeem it, you have to go back to centralized entity. At that point, the centralized entity can say these tokens are invalid because they were reported stolen. And so that gate was, which also has its implications, which we'll discuss in a few minutes. But then there were some wallets that were marked as, you know, tainted wallets. And which, by the way, the system itself has, you know, you have services, for example, like Tornado Cash called Mixers, which just like what we have with this shell companies allows you to be able to create multiple wallets, move, clean the currency up and show up in a different wallet completely clean. You know, so the Mixers are employed.
Are they totally effective, the Mixers, Nitin?
In some cases, because unlike paper trail, which requires a human intelligence and requires other elements, everything in blockchain is trackable and traceable. So it's a matter of a better software to analyze, a better design for you to be able to connect the dots. And it's, you know, using the graph technology, so to speak, which allows you to be able to detect these things, even predict the movement of money to the next wallet with certain level of certainty around this. So Slomist was able to detect those, communicate that to community. And this is all a matter of hours, by the way. It didn't take months or weeks. And Poly Network appealed to many networks to say, hey, these wallets are, and Slomist was also able to determine IP addresses tied to the transactions, in some cases, email addresses and identity, because in some, you know, the hacker, which as a white hacker, not particularly smart, because he ended up moving some of these assets into the custodial wallets, which means that these are KYC wallets that are maintained on these exchanges. So not exactly the smartest thing to do, but apparently that happened. And so now they knew the identity of this person, or at least potential person. And so in that spirit, half the money was returned instantly. And all this happened within a matter of hours, which is such a fantastic story, you know, I think. And now there were
so other to clarify that then the $340 million that was returned within hours, the white hat hacker, did he return that $340 million or did the custodians return?
No, he returned it.
Yeah.
He returned it. He didn't want to. And there were messages to say, hey, I'm not really after the money. I'm giving this back to you. And, you know, I just want to make sure there's a vulnerability. And he was hoping to actually, and there was a communication which was disclosed later on that he did ask for, I think, $100 million as a white hacker fee, which the industry, you know, with the 5%, which is $5 million as opposed to $100 million, would have been a fair, you know, a transaction value. But in this entire scheme of things, this entire interesting movie, as we talk about, all this was resolved in a matter of a day or two, right? A few questions came up. Could we have done the same level of diligence, same level of analysis in the existing financial system? And the answer to that, you know, is no, because
no,
you know, we had to rely upon humans and law jurisdiction, which is in different countries, different banks, different financial institutions. And that would take forever. Second thing is Tether. And Mike Belshi on one of the podcasts, who is the CEO and founder for BitGo, a custodian and a digital asset service provider in the United States. He was on the fence when, and there were some assets that they were custodying, which were affected. And the question was, should he respond to freezing those assets, only because
That's right.
And the debate after the effect ensued to say, did Tether do the right thing? Because at the end of the day, it's not keys, not your wallet, which means if you have a bad design, you've got to pay for it. The ethos of the decentralized world, should we preserve that? Because if we start having these governance control, even though in this case, purely ethical, the right thing to do for the wrong act, whatever the intentions may be, is that the right? So those questions popped up. So not just the fact this is done real time, use of optimum use of technology, tracking and tracing, But the adjacent ecosystem that responded with agility raised a bunch of questions, good and bad. Good, the fact that community came together. There was a general thinking that we should not taint our industry, and acts like this will make it harder for regulations to pass in the future. But also, I think that some things in terms of, do custodians have an advantage in this situation? Do they become counterparties? And those are interesting questions, I think. So I'll take a pause, Derek, and just get your thoughts. You have been around for quite some time. You've seen banking system. Just want to get your thoughts on, you know, what do you think? What do you think, you know, especially around freezing and forfeiture, which is one of the hallmarks of any regulatory framework in terms of enforcement. Not your case.
Well, it was interesting to see, it was interesting to see the community come back and snap at Tether and say, it's not your business to stop this payment. And so, you know, a clash in belief systems is occurred there. The first belief system is that there's something wrong. You know, we have an obligation because we're an authority. Well, they're not. They're a currency, a cryptocurrency, but they've chosen the role to be an authority. And with that role chosen, they've then stopped the payment. Now, that was a good outcome for the 610 million process and FEF, 611 million. However, the community immediately started to debate whether these centralized currencies actually should play such a role in how such a transaction occurred. And that is, I think that's just a sign of health. It's a sign of a health of a community that's actually turning around and saying, we're thinking about this. We're thinking about it because we don't have someone holding our hand telling us what we should do. We don't have a regulation that says those people in that position must do that. So the community itself is able to debate and consider whether, you know, right intent ultimately might become heavy-handed engagement and management of how monies are transacted, which I know philosophically the community doesn't want. So I see that interesting little, as again, an eddy within the river of this story that we see happening here. And I think there are many, many eddies in the river. I mean, you know, white hat hackers, communities gathering together, people saying, you know, this is, I'm not going to let you transact these, you know, authorities saying I'm holding back this money. All of these represent little subcultures in this culture that is the domain of cryptocurrencies and digital assets. Well, how about we jump for a moment and discuss something that I have to say, at the very least, I adore the name. And this is a currency that's being created in the Philippines called Smooth Love Potion. I love it. I'd like all currencies to come up with a similar name that actually is engaging, because then the discussions around the place could be, how much smooth love potion, you know, would you like for, I don't know, a wonderful head massage or something like that in reply currency. Anyway, so Smooth Love Potion, of course, is a currency that's created, SLP it's called, is created by Axies. And it's the outcome of a play to earn game, which is now forming really part of the Philippine financial community, particularly for the low-earning Philippines. Now, COVID has hit the Philippines very hard. I have a VA, Vivian, that works up in the Philippines, and I've retained her since 2013. She's wonderful, and she finds herself now locked in at her apartment for long periods of time because COVID has reduced her ability to go out. But she has a job. Many others don't, and they're living hand to mouth. And so they've discovered that Axie has created a game where they can pay to play. And they're broadly getting between $400 to $700 US a month, which is often more than their salaries or earnings that they may have earned before. And this is now creating an interesting thing, because to join this space, you need to have some $2,500-$3,000 to buy a position. And so now universities have been created where people, like a friend of mine here in Australia, has purchased a number of university allotments, and they then share, they then put the money up front and enable these gamers to generate income, and they share the split of income in some form or other. So again, you're getting a new industry that's arrived, a new income generation, a new currency that's getting utilized, and even that's getting jumped from country to country with sponsors and universities that have occurred to enable it to happen. You know a great deal about payment gateways. We talked about this a little bit before. Yes. You spent a great deal of time in the space. You traveled around the place looking at phone credits. What do you think is different with this, apart from this beautiful name, this smooth love potion currency?
I think we talked about this last time a little bit in terms of Philippines and how it's impacted. So look, one thing is great that, and I'm not a gamer. My son is, and I did actually have to talk to him about what is the economic system here, because as a technical guy, I like to understand what is things of value and how do, you know, and we talk about this both in our investment thesis as well, like what gives a token its value. And it's a combination of, for example, Pokemon, where my son, when he was younger, he would go to all these places and catch these Pokemon, and they would breed these eggs, and they would give birth to new Pokemons. And if they happen to be rare, then they would have enormous amount of value. So that's what Axie Infinity sort of, in a nutshell, that's the program. And I think during pandemic, and I have some stats, which, you know, I was listening to while I was running this afternoon, Philippines had about 19% of their entire, so it's 100 million plus population of the country, and 19% of them are getting on this bandwagon of digital assets. And Axie Infinity is one of the many that are sort of emerging. But Axie Infinity caught attention because during pandemic, people were constrained. They had the time, but they also needed a source of income. And they used this avenue, and overnight, you know, the entire family, they had access to their phones, and they were using their phones to be able to breed these, you know, these eggs that would give birth to new Axies, and they would be unique and would buy and sell these things. Essentially, treating these as NFTs, non-fungible token, as unique tokens that represented a community and of these axes that are spread all over, and they have certain capabilities which could be employed into gaming and so on and so forth. And what's interesting is that first wave, a secondary market was created because axes at the time, using the underlying layer one protocols, whether it's ETH or Flow, depending on what they were using, they were trying to use that as a mechanism to translate axes to ETHs and sell ETHs to be able to, and you had two sort of step process, which was a little bit complicated, as you can understand, for common people to have an ETH wallet. And so next thing you know, have an Axie wallet. And the wallet wars continue. And that's a complicated space even for common people at the moment. And so within a matter of a week and a half, you had an exchange that directly converted Axies to Filipino pesos within a matter of a week. So you could basically take your Axies, convert them into pesos, use that money to feed your family, and continue over and over again. And you're right, the number is $400 to $700 a month for a family of four, which is much, much more than what an average family makes with a normal day job that families have in Philippines.
So Nitin, let me jump in and give you some names here of businesses. So in a matter of week, there was a system to exchange it to standard currency, right? But within the same short period of time, there were businesses taking SLP for money, full stop. Don't worry about exchanging it. So here's a few: Echo Wash, Swab Republic, Little Blossoms, Solid Toys, Mama's Boy, The Architect. All of these are Philippine businesses that immediately just put their hand up and said, we take SLP as currency. And that happened in breakneck speed. I mean, how long did it take for, you know, a government to issue a new set of currencies? You know, in the case of Australia, they converted from the English pound to the Australian dollar in the 1960s. That would have been a nightmare. And of course, gold took hundreds of thousands of years to become currency, et cetera, et cetera. And here we are, a group within weeks that have had just, these are a name of few businesses that have put their hand up and said, right, we take SLP.
Yeah, and Derek, I built a payment network. It took me 2.5 years with blessing of my employer, and we had to go through regulatory hoops for all the right reasons because it's a regulated environment. Mm. But you know, like for us to build payment gateways, the regulatory work that we had to get in terms of permissions, build the technology gateways, get banks on board, it was an average corridor for me to get one bank or one financial institution in two parts of the corridor between two countries was a 3 to 4 month journey. Leave alone movement and then subsequent acceptance of those funds. So I think that not only, so there are two elements of this piece, right? Yes, payments are complicated, it's regulated, it's hard, but these gateways provide avenues for point of sale systems to say, hey, if you accept Axis, then we will instantly convert them to you and you will have access to cash in your bank, which is a lot more easier. Also remember this, right? That if that became sort of a fungible currency, even though it's a non-fungible token, but if it became a fungible currency or a belief system in a country, then in absence of jobs, in absence of traditional fiat, as a result of productivity in turn of what you would get, Axis became a currency of sorts. And that phenomenon, I think, is such a telling of our times that the adoption is just a matter of a switch, which may take a week or two, and no longer the barriers to entry is purely from a traditional financial gateway. And that is leading to all the statistics that you described earlier in terms of Thailand and Korea and India looking into this and saying, India has 79 million, from tier two cities, and we'll talk about that in a minute, which is such a telling sign of everybody wanting to get away from this, the shell of poverty and the normal day-to-day job, and participate equally in an economic system.
Yeah, it's so true. You start listening to when people discuss whether Bitcoin, by example, we're allowed to mention the name in this show, whether Bitcoin, by example, is a gold-based or a physical-based, it's not, currency. So therefore it is of no value. And that takes an entire long discussion to discuss community size, value of the algorithm that runs it, et cetera, et cetera. This consensus network that runs it, et cetera. And then by the time you've gone through all that explanation, more than often they still look at you and go, but I don't understand, there's nothing physical to it. And here you are in the Philippines that have brought out SLP, and no one's arguing whether there's anything physical to it. It's just instantly become an asset. No one's turning around and saying, is it backed by gold or is there US dollar tether connected to it or anything else? It's just instantly an asset. So is this because we're dealing with a generation here that aren't connected to gold, which I have to say occasionally, the Gen Y refer to it as boomer rocks. Because they're just not interested in gold. Why would they be interested in gold? They don't understand it. So here you have a generation that's trading in SLP, another eddy within the current, which is, this is not the Philippines that are trading in SLP. This is a generation within the Philippines. Now, there are some exceptions to that, but generally a generation in the Philippines that's trading in SLP. And they're not looking for a validation of the value of their transaction. They're just looking for their transaction to occur. Do you think that's what we're seeing here? This is also a generational play?
And so two things, right? One is the phenomenon that we've seen in Philippines that you're talking about is not new, right? We call them community currencies in many parlance. And as I've been building the central bank digital currency projects around the world, we had to go back and looking into what is money. And there are many definitions of money, but for example, the bookish definition of money is, it is unit of account, medium of exchange, store of value. Any currency in the world needs to have these three characteristics for it to be money. But at the end of the day, the most basic definition, which is the oldest meme of our times, that money is a belief system. It's basically collective belief of what we all agree upon. And there are examples after examples all around the world of community coins where, because of scarcity phenomenon of money itself, there were a lot of communities who sort of build a pseudo currency of sorts to maintain productivity, to be able to maintain an exchange mechanism that allowed. So I think to me, Axis, or the example that you cited in Philippines, is sort of morphing of the same community coin concept into the digital era, that they you have a collective belief system which gave you an avenue to be able to, you know, to take things of value, which sort of became unit of account. It also became medium of exchange, because now stores begin to buy into the belief system. And store of value is still an open question, but the whole notion is that currencies like this are constantly in circulation. They're not meant to be store of value. And so while starting these financial systems, I'll tell you this, that of course I was not born 1900s, but a lot of examples from paper-based systems that mimic what axes are today, to me is a lot of similarities between the two, except that the rate at which the pace and the digital manifestation of this is much more different, but conceptually they are the same. So this is essentially, again, a digital way of creating value and disposing value, which has not existed before, I think.
Yes. So essentially, it's just a belief system. Wow, fancy that, which is all of these things. So I just popped away for camera for those that are actually watching this on YouTube. And I popped away to get something because I wanted to show you the longest running currency in the world. And here it is, everybody. Can you see it?
Curry shells.
Yes, the longest running currency in the world. It ran for 11,000 years and it stopped in 1926 in the Solomon Islands. And in 1926, they replaced it with a coin, which had an image of the shell on it, so that people were confident about the transfer from the curry shells. And so, you know, before we get overly bent out of shape about the backing of a transactionable, reasonably high volume currency, it is a belief system. And we may see more eddies of these belief systems occurring, more localized currencies that appear and disappear. The extraordinary thing about the digital environment or the digital currencies is, in the future, when you've got a wallet, you'll be able to flick left and right to be able to swap that belief system, that shell, for a token and have that occur. And therefore, these subsections will be able to exist. Maybe, who knows, maybe they'll actually all disappear and we'll get towards the some global currency. We don't know that, but we'll see. But at the end of the day, it is a belief system. Hey, one last thing for this week, and that is Visa's purchase of $150,000, punk token, and bless them. Someone said, you know, what a waste of money. And I remember looking at them going, clearly you're not a marketer. This was $150,000 marketing ploy, and whoever did it should get a little crown and walk around the place and people bless him, because it was an extraordinarily great marketing ploy for Visa. What did you think of that that purchase? And, you know, you don't have to discuss whether you think the art value is worth that, but what did you think of Visa trying to head towards this direction? What does that mean?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. And I think both Visa and I work, of course, with many of these clients, both in the industry and on panels that we talk about their whole goals and where things are. Of course, I think two things, right? One is looking into NFTs and non-fungible tokens and what they're meant to do and what they have become now are two different elements. And we should certainly have a separate podcast on that. But what happened this week was notable, both from a Visa investing, let's say, you know, $150,000 for an NFT token or somewhere around the same valuation. And the bang they got there for their buck, both in terms of people writing about it, the marketing element that you talked about, which they don't have to do anything. They didn't have to do media outreach or nothing. They just bought a token that just spread like wildfire. And Kai Sheffield, who is sort of their the head of crypto projects in Visa, did talk about this whole element to say, hey, we do want to get into this, understanding the space, figuring out the rails that move NFTs, figuring out the custody of the NFTs and transactional value of NFTs. So there's an understanding element to it, which if you spend 30 cents on an NFT, then maybe you don't have the same level of care that you would by spending $50,000. But at the same time, I think with that level of valuation, it did two things. And you're absolutely right. It's external marketing, of course, that we all hear about. But it is also internal marketing. For a company to be, for any department head to go and get $150,000 approved for things that are not easily understood by corporate America for the most part. I think that's just brilliant for them to be able to sell this concept to Visa and internally and make that expense and go and buy this and eventually have the external marketing. Though there's a long theory of what I think where this is heading besides marketing on the long run, but you're absolutely right. And Budweiser did the same thing. They got beer.eth as a domain. And they also got, they did spend close to $250,000 on between the NFT and that domain that they spent this week. And again, we've seen many of the, from marketing angle perspective, begin to look into this as an investment from NFT point, from NFT. NBA has looked at it in terms of not just Top Shot, yep. NBA having their own NFTs and having distribution during the games and so on and so forth. So massive momentum around this. Though I think we should dedicate the entire week for NFTs because what we had envisioned when I was running some of the projects at IBM is looking at NFTs as truly non-fungible tokens, as identity and as healthcare records. They are unique. They belong to you. And while people can misuse it, they cannot assume you, which is what the existing identity systems. And so we start the journey of NFT from there, then the squiggly art that's out there, and then we have to look at the value of this. So to me, it's, I don't know if it's purely a social experiment in terms of bringing art and technology together, combined with the economic system. And that's something which is interesting, I think.
Look, I'd love to have a bit more of a chat at a future event where we can discuss social NFTs. Yes. They're truly fascinating. The ability to become a member, again, of community, and follow an artist, whether they're a singer, a painter, a sculptor, or a sporting star, and become important in that community and enable the star to generate their return without some third-party broker or organization stepping in between him and his fans or admirers. I keep saying him, I mean that, of course, could be him or her. And so I'm very keen to have that conversation because what can lead from it is quite extraordinary commerce. But I think what we've gone through today is what I hope we continue on in a base philosophy, and that is the confluence of technology and community, because without the community, the technology doesn't exist, but without the technology, the community can't come together. And it is this democratization of assets, this fluidity of currency, and this community spirit that steps in and says, no, you can't steal $611 million. We won't let it happen. That we're seeing a new belief system appear. And that new belief system may be our future. Am I being too altruistic here? I just get a sense that there's a chance that a belief system will change where you've got enabling technology to make it happen.
I mean, Derek, I love the way you framed that. I couldn't have said it any better and so eloquently. And you're absolutely right. I think community and technology, the ability for, and there are n number of examples that we talked about today. Philippines, 79 million Indians who have signed up for participating in this ecosystem from tier two cities. These are cities that are not exactly well-known cities, and yet the population is looking into creating secondary income because they cannot get rich by just having a job. And they want to break free from that, which only a few in the world have access to it. And so I think you're absolutely right that community is trying to employ technology and technology needs community. And it's in community's interest to govern it, which is the example we discussed early on of how the $611 million was fixed by its own without any intervention at the moment because community came together. Because there's a dependence on technology trying to attract community and community trying to attract technology and consume it without hurting people and without breaking laws. I think that's the direction that this may be heading in. And I'll tell you this, that talking about NFTs, there are poetries. I just heard this today. This ETH's poem is creating poetry on NFTs. And that just keeps getting interesting, which to me is a feature of media, for instance, as to how we consume media in future, use of digital rights management and so on and so forth. And NFT in general, I think we should dedicate a topic to this for our next sort of talk, because Solana, its entire growth, NFTs are responsible. I mean, there was something called a Degenerate Ape Academy. Look at the name of this NFT project.
Great had, name.
It's a great name, I think. And that had led to a massive growth, which led to a massive appreciation of Solana itself. And so while many of these projects were trying to beat Ether, it is something as simple as NFT that actually brought them to prominence because of, you know, their appeal and their value and the community that supports these things. So kudos to that analysis, I think, Derek.
Yeah, very good. So we're getting to the end of our discussion. I hope everyone's enjoyed it. It is going to consistently be how we talk about this space, which is this involvement in how belief systems and human nature are getting involved with technology. There's an endless amount of topics for us to be able to talk about every single week, which is wonderful. Nitin and I are very approachable. So if you want to be able to communicate with us, it's nitin@portal.am or Derek, D-E-R-Y-C-K, @portal.am. Please, if you enjoy this, subscribe, like it, share it with friends, and let this community grow. Thank you very much indeed. And we look forward to hearing from you along the way. And we'll be back again next week. Thanks, Nitin.
See you next week, guys. Bye.